Hey everyone, welcome back to the 443 Security Simplified. I'm your host, Mark LaLiberty, and joining me today is...
Corey Activist Knockreiner.
Good. It wasn't cabin fever this time, and I'm glad you're standing up for something, even if you are sitting down right now.
How do you know? Oh yeah, we're on webcam.
On today's episode, we cover a few news stories, including targeted attacks against advocacy groups, political campaigns, and a nuclear warhead. And I think with that, Let's go ahead and jump in.
Mark is dropping bombs already.
Bombs away. So first up on the docket, last week, Cloudflare published a blog post that was detailing an increase in cyber attacks over the week when compared to the week before. So they were specifically looking into a spike in attacks over the weekend of May 30th and 31st, which coincided with all of the protests in the United States and really across the world by the end of the weekend. And they noted that they had blocked a 17% more attacks than during the same weekend the month prior, which equated to 19 billion more attacks, or 110,000 additional attacks per second. Yeah. So in their post, like, they actually started out by saying, on average, Google receives like 60,000 and change requests or searches per second. Meanwhile, they're blocking an additional 110,000 attacks per second, which is just absolutely mind-blowing, the amount of like DDoS traffic that they have to put up with and that they successfully mitigate. It's actually kind of impressive.
Yeah, that's a huge, 17% sounds like a significant increase, period. But when you realize that 17% equals 19 billion more,
yes,
you just realize the pure volume of the hits they're tracking.
17% when you're talking in the tens of billions is absolutely nuts. And these are just blocked requests, by the way. Like, obviously, legitimate traffic is still allowed through. These are just the ones that they blocked for DDoS protection and other attempted web application exploits, too. So they were looking into why the spike happened. You can probably guess why the spike happened around that weekend. When they started drilling down into different categories, they found that the category of sites that they protected with the largest increase in cyber attacks was advocacy groups, which had a 1,120% or times increase when compared to the month prior. Basically, they went from almost no attacks in all of April to peaking at 20,000 requests per second on a single site that Cloudflare was blocking then. Attacks against government websites were up 1.8 times, and military were up 3.8 too.
Can we pause at advocacy groups? Yeah. I mean, I kind of support advocacy groups. You know, make sure I'm understanding this right. Advocacy groups are people speaking out against corruption and problems and racism. Am I right in that? Or
yeah.
Are advocacy groups advocating the other side of the thing?
They didn't go into detail of what sites were categorized on it. I'd be willing to bet that there are still some like opposite ends of the political spectrum that they would classify as advocacy groups, like advocating for what you and I might think things.
So it could go both. It could go both ways. Yes. So, okay. That makes sense. So I can't really it sounds like this is a hacktivism, to throw out one of the terms we use for threat actors. DDoSing advocacy groups is something you do for political reasons to push your political message. And I was going to get kind of mad at this hacking, but I guess what you're saying is there could be advocacy groups that might be pushing the other side, or something that may be, you know, an alternate opinion.
That's just my thought is yes, but also, like, I know historically Cloudflare has been really against, they have not been afraid to take a political stance on things that they personally believe in, things like racism, and they have kicked off like white supremacist blogs.
You're saying they believe against racism?
Yes.
It came out weird. Things they believe in, like racism. I think you meant the opposite.
Yes, exactly. Things they believe in, terrible things. But I mean, they've kicked off like white supremacy blogs, for example, from their service. And so my thought would be the overwhelming majority of the advocacy category would be politically leaning organizations that align with what Cloudflare has historically supported, which would mean like anti-racism stuff like that.
So potentially this could be Black Lives Matter and stuff.
Yep.
In which case, this is... You know, the sad thing is I don't think DDoSing is ever kind of right. But at least with hacktivism, sometimes when it's a public opinion that I believe is ethical and moral, I wouldn't be as against. But this, it just seems horrible that we're going through such a tough time. You know, what happened is horrible and should not have happened. And yet there's people out there that are DDoSing the groups that are trying to help. I think that's just sad.
It is. It's pretty gross. Even outside that, so that was in a 1,120 times increase. Government websites that are protected by Cloudflare saw a 1.8 times increase. Military was increased by 3.8.
1.8, 3.8, that's like nothing. The only story should be the 1,120 time increase.
With that said,
that's a big difference.
Like, I'm willing to bet government and military already saw a pretty fair share versus like the near zero that some of these advocacy groups faced previously. So a 1.8 times increase by volume might still be similar to the volume increase for the advocacy groups, just to be, you know, contrarian. But anyways, they also talked about in their blog post something that I actually wasn't familiar with that they have been running, something they call Project Galileo, which they created to protect vulnerable targets like artistic groups, humanitarian organizations, and voices of political dissent from cyber attacks.
By the way, today you're back to Cloudflare, just because we were talking about government website, but Project Galileo is a Cloudflare project, right?
Correct, yes. Basically, it's a project where people that qualify for those categories or organizations that qualify for those categories can submit a application to apply for free security services from Cloudflare, basically. And they noted that in the same week of this like data that they were looking at, they saw a dramatic increase in cyber attacks targeting participants of Project Galileo. So they showed a chart in this blog post. And it goes from effectively zero attacks, like hovering right around zero in the scale of the chart, to just shy of 140 million requests per day blocked over the course of that weekend. And like you said, I think it sucks. Like, we are going through a really rough time in our country, both like obviously from the pandemic, but now because of all this like awful systemic racism finally coming to a head. And there's people that are going out there trying to silence voices digitally now too. And it's just, I don't know. It seems like if you're a hacker, maybe pick your battles and go after real baddies. But I don't know. Who am I to say?
No, if you're the one going after what's right, we're going to win. Go away. Mm-hmm. And here's a question that might be a good segue to other things we're talking about. I wonder who the who is. Like, obviously, if you pay attention to media in our country, there might be polarization, and these could be personal people that have very differing beliefs than my own. I won't try to pick our audience's beliefs, but I very much believe the George Floyd situation is something that needs to change, and police need to police their bad apples. But maybe it's not as simple. Maybe, you know... what's the quote? I think there's a military quote that is to divide and conquer. Like, if you're an attacking body or if you are an adversary of another country, you want polarization. You want them to be divided. And I think we'll be talking about some other things that have to do with elections and stuff. And our military are at least smart generals, maybe not some of the generals that attack citizens in their own country, but smart generals realize that united we stand. So it'd be interesting to know where this increased volume is coming from. Is it personal? Is it ourselves? Are we fighting internally? Or is it external forces that have some sort of desire to continue dividing a polarized nation?
And I know the word you're trying to avoid saying right here is Russia, but we have seen like evidence that Russia, for example, hasn't just stirred the pot on one side, but they've also stirred the pot on the other side of political discussions to basically go to the extremes of both ends to just make everyone hate each other. And it makes sense if you're trying to cause like, what's the word I'm looking for? A lot of dissent and like just arguments and have a country basically fall to pieces. That is the way to do it. So
divided, I agree. Divide and conquer.
I'm curious who is doing it.
Yeah, and I think Russia won't be the only actor doing this. I think we'll find out that other political parties, other political nations, maybe ones that are more aligned with Russia, have reasons to do this too.
We probably will in our next news story. But before we move on to that one, though, I did want to point out that, like, I looked more into this Project Galileo thing from Cloudflare, and it's actually pretty dang cool. If you do happen to be a part of an organization that qualifies for it, like working on humanitarian rights or civil society, even journalism and people fighting for democracy and undemocratic countries, you can submit an application and get free, for example, DDoS protection from Cloudflare. And as we've seen, blocking billions of DDoS attacks, it's pretty dang impressive and could be quite useful.
Yeah, I gotta admit, I kind of go back and forth on with Cloudflare, but right now I'm more on the pro Cloudflare side because of things like this. I know that they also sometimes they apply their protections and under things I agree with, like freedom of speech or privacy, but sometimes some of their protections can be leveraged by bad actors that are trying to hide and bulletproof their own negative sites too.
Which is, they've not been afraid to kick them off.
Project Galileo's fent. Yeah. But this Project Galileo is just awesome.
Yeah. So look into that if you qualify as one of those groups. Otherwise, just, I guess, be on the lookout for people trying to use our current situations and turmoil to divide us as a country. And it's not going to be just the United States, it's going to be all across the world.
And even personally, yourself, I mean, we've reminded you many times that anytime there's something that's big in pop culture, including this George Floyd thing, scammers will use it too. It's not just these people trying to create dissent, but it might be the topic of simple phishing or other online scams. So be careful of it. As you're donating maybe to things that you believe in, feel free to continue donating to legitimate organizations you believe in, but definitely be careful of scammers that use things like increased donations to profit themselves.
Yep, well said. So moving on, last week we talked about Google's threat analysis group in one of the recent publications where they went over some of their quarterly findings for the months of January through March. Well, actually, at the end of last week, the head of Google Tag tweeted out a statement that they had identified a Chinese APT targeting the Biden campaign and an Iranian APT targeting staffers of the Trump campaign, both with phishing emails. And they did note that there were no signs of actual compromise yet, but they did still notify the users and law enforcement agencies regardless. And like you mentioned, and like we've seen previously, these external threat actors and nation-state-backed hackers and phishers have really been active around elections in the United States. Like in 2016, they compromised the DNC and the Clinton campaign, funny enough, with a phish to a link to an Excel document that was titled Hillary Clinton Favorable Ratings.xl. You can see why a staffer might have fallen for that one. They're not going to let up. Like, especially considering nothing really happened when it came to investigating and trying to stop this stuff from happening. And so I would anticipate that in 2020, we continue to see more and more reports like this of nation states going after our political parties to try and gain dirt and maybe leverage that to assist one party or just to, like we just discussed in the last section, cause turmoil and discord.
Yeah, I think, you might be able to argue one nation state might want one party or another to win for their own purposes, but I actually doubt that's really what their motivation is. I think their motivation is pure dissent and polarization. Again, divide and conquer. You know, like you mentioned with the evidence or the at least allegations we have with the Russian cases in 2016 and a little bit in 2018, they went both sides. Their idea was not to necessarily make one side win and tip over, but to just make sure both sides had total polarization and were getting totally opposite messages, whether true or not. They want to breed the polarization in our country. Unfortunately, the best situation there, the United We Stand, all starts with a leader who unites us.
Yeah, wouldn't that be nice?
but I can, I'll remind people that what unites us is each other in our community. So with lack of leadership in uniting, whether or not you believe that's the case, at least unite with each other. You might have different beliefs than other people in some things, but I bet you on as far as humanity, United States, Constitution, equal rights, we're probably a lot more alike.
Yeah, I would agree.
Don't let people polarize you.
And we've talked a lot, both on this podcast and our security predictions we put out every year, about election hacking and like what we expect to happen. Like, I think you and I both still agree that we're not going to see people go after like voting systems and changing voter actual votes within electronic systems, yeah. Assuming we even use them this year. Like, who knows, maybe the second wave of this pandemic forces everyone to vote by mail.
Yeah. Although in some states like ours, we already do it. And by the way, when we tell you that, we're not discounting that electronic voting can be hacked. In fact, we know quite well that many of the voting machines out there have had vulnerabilities and can be hacked. It just seems like not the most viable target right now. I mean, Mark and I have gone back and forth and talked about situations where, yeah, in a specific state, it might be worth the effort of physical hacks. But obviously, if a nation state wanted to breed dissent in a country, they can do so with much softer mechanisms. So I just don't think they need to pull out the big guns.
Yeah.
That said, I think you're getting to probably, there, if they are going to do some hard hacking, you know, there are other targets than the actual election, the voting systems.
Yeah, like our prediction, one of our predictions we had for this year was that they would go after the registration systems instead. Like, we saw evidence released by intelligence communities in the United States that leading up to the 2018 and 2016 elections, foreign threat adversaries were prodding and probing our voter registration systems. And in many states, they didn't do anything, but they gained access where they could have modified stuff or deleted stuff if they wanted to. And you don't have to change a vote if you can just delete someone from the voter registration and prevent them from voting at all in the first place, if you really want to actively tamper with an election.
And by the way, I think this is a bigger risk now, because while I guess there's some people that are trying to breed fear in mail-based voting, even though all the evidence suggests that it works just fine, and many states already adopt it. I would say the fact that if you do have this mail-based voting, we've mentioned protections of checking with the voter registration before you go to vote physically. You know, now, you know, having that tie to, did my mail-in ballot actually go through? Was I registered when it happened? I think there could be a potentially higher threat. Although I still actually attest another way you could use this voter registration in a soft way, rather than just deleting registered voters to cause a lot of voting day problems, is simply knowing who's Democrat and knowing who's Republican. And that helps you target some of the social media and fake news and DDoS, that could help them target just some of their information and misinformation they're spreading around.
And it's not like a bunch of voter political registration information was leaked a few years ago because of an insecure S3 bucket or anything.
You're right. Nothing ever leaks. There's rarely data breaches, so we're probably okay there.
Wasn't it like tens of millions or like 100 million records of Republican voter registration information that was stored in an Amazon S3 bucket that was exposed to the internet? Like, if you're looking for potential targets for disinformation, that's like the mother load right there.
Yeah. So who knows how they use it, but I think just even the registration information is what we think is most useful to them and probably what they'll target. Although I have to admit, even if they don't target any of that, we seem to be doing a good job of working ourselves up against each other on things like social media. Yeah. And while some of that might be self-imposed, I actually think there's a lot of help coming from different places.
And when it comes to disinformation campaigns, like, obviously Cambridge Analytica was a big story back in 2016, and you might think they've been like dismantled and gone for good. In reality, they actually just changed their name to Emerdata, and they're still in existence. So companies like that still exist. You're still going to see people harvesting social media information details and trying to sway public opinion. I don't know what we can do other than like educate everyone to treat stuff with skepticism and maybe check multiple sources, but good luck getting everyone to do that.
Yeah, I think it ultimately comes from each other. We have to unite and hopefully have a leader that helps unite us.
Hopefully someday. So moving on, our next news story is actually a leak of the plot for Mission Impossible 7, where Sky News just reported last week that West Tech International, what's that?
I was going to say, so it's not just Die Hard 4 movies that I used to laugh at that are now actually coming true.
It feels like this one is a lead up to it could fit right into a movie plot. So Sky News reported that West Tech International, who is a subcontractor of Northrop Grumman, and a company that provides critical support to the U.S. Minuteman III nuclear intercontinental ballistic missile program, recently suffered a cyber attack that resulted in ransomware infecting the company's machines and documents being stolen and subsequently leaked online. Now, so far, none of these stolen documents have included classified information, but it does look like the attackers did have access to really sensitive systems, considering many of the documents included payroll information and emails. And the attackers are basically threatening to publish all of their stolen files if West Tech fails to pay the demanded ransom. Now, the ransomware is supposedly reported to be Maze, M-A-Z-E, which operates under an affiliate model, which I thought was kind of interesting. We've talked a lot about ransomware as a service before, and it's interesting seeing a ransomware as a service payload targeting, I mean, honestly, they may be a small name company that I had never heard of prior to this week, but it's a big target if they're a part of our nuclear missile deterrent program. So this story was also interesting because it's basically a double whammy. Like, they're demanding they pay a ransom, not just to recover their files, which they might have been able to do anyway because of backups, but also to stop the leaks. And I was wondering, like, what are your thoughts? Is this like, should we expect this as the new norm for ransomware? We've already seen campaigns where they sit on a network for a while before infecting systems, and now are they going to be harvesting our stuff?
Yeah, I should have prepared more, but this isn't the first time. I'm pretty sure that it's in the past year, a couple of companies that got hit with ransomware have also got hit with, hey, you will also out this information if you don't pay. So I, unfortunately, yes. I mean, if you think from the attacker's perspective, this is kind of another nefarious psychological trick. And it's kind of less a psychological trick and more a potential hard one, because depending on your company, you know, the depth of your breach could have reputation effects. Now, I'm personally all for it. If you get breached and you lose information, customer information, your information, transparency is actually far better for your reputation in the long run, in my opinion. But I think a lot of companies, depending on what they lose, you know, having people know is just another, you know, motivator for them to pay, which is unfortunate because I still don't think paying is the right way to go in the long term. But I definitely, I see this type of attack increasing. By the way, also not the first time we've seen Maze, right? I believe even in some other attacks that we know of, our analysts have analyzed ransomware that turned out to be Maze related.
Yeah, and it also, like, it kind of makes sense. Like, ransomware has been this constantly, like, evolving thing where back in 2015, 2016 is when we really had those big blasted, like, target everyone, just send everyone ransomware campaigns. That's when it became a billion-dollar industry. But in response to that, IT teams and even just individuals got better at responding to ransomware, got better at training their users to not click on phishes and stuff like that. But then ransomware became more targeted, going after specific verticals that might not have their, like, healthcare, where they tend to have legacy systems, or MSSPs, where they tend to have elevated access to a wide number of systems. And now, like, as organizations are getting better with backup and restoration procedures, where maybe they don't need to pay the ransom. Yes, obviously it sucks to be down for potentially like a whole day while you're restoring all of your data, but at least you can get your data back. Makes sense for these cyber criminals now to steal your data and then try and leak anything that might be of value online if you don't pay. Basically, Like, you mentioned customer records, like the reputation hit of losing your user database is really crappy, but what if your company relies heavily on intellectual property, for example, and if your trade secrets get out there, someone else can copy them and basically encroach on your own market share? Same deal with like this specific incident where they're a subcontractor that handles intercontinental ballistic missiles with nuclear warheads attached. Like, they probably have a lot of really sensitive data that they do not want to get out in the hands of other nation states.
But so I agree, and that's the psychological motivator. But guess what? It's out there, right? By the very nature, the attacker has it. And yes, you could say you paid the ransom, but if that, do you really think if that IP or those nuclear codes are that valuable IP, that they're really then going to delete them and never sell them to the highest bidder? Sure, they may not leak it publicly, but the data's gone. You're not doing yourself any favors. You're simply enforcing people that are using this as a profit motivator to continue using it because it's giving them profit. So I hate to say it, but I get the intellectual property part, and that's why I think ultimately it's a hit to reputation and to their business. But to be frank, it's too late. The data's been lost.
Yeah, you generally cannot trust someone who broke into your network and stole your data to be a trustworthy person when it comes to deleting that data after you've paid them. And like you said,
and the more valuable it is, if it really were nuclear codes, I guarantee you they're going to be taking it to nation states for 7 or 8 figures. Yeah. Your ransom is not going to be something they care about.
Yeah, and all your ransom does is just guarantee that they now have more funding and incentive to do additional attacks against other people and you yourself, because they know that you pay in the event that you've had a breach. So
I wonder, maybe this is a new prediction, Mark. How many ransomware groups are going to change their name? Like go through 2 years of calling them XYZ with Maze Ransomware and get a lot of people to pay. And then 3 years later, now they're suddenly, you know, ABC Ransomware Group doing the same thing to the same companies that they already breached. Maybe they left a back door and that you never found from their first breach. And now it seems to be a new ransomware author asking you for stuff.
Stop giving the criminals ideas.
They have these ideas. I think my point is stop giving criminals money. that's what will motivate them to continue doing what they do.
Agreed entirely. So our last news story has to do with a feature from Apple called Sign In with Apple. It's similar to OAuth 2.0 in that it lets users sign in to other services using their Apple
story
ID.
Story over, Mark. You can stop now. You said Apple. They're obviously bulletproof. Nothing's going to be wrong. And OAuth 2 even. It's not even the first OAuth. OAuth is a great, great standard and protocol. So I don't think there's news here. Let's just move on.
Yeah, exactly. The end. So if you haven't used Sign In with Apple,
okay, what is it?
A lot of popular services have it as an option, like Dropbox, Spotify, and Airbnb let you sign in with your Apple ID instead of creating an account directly on those services. Well, last week, security researcher, Bhavok Jain, disclosed their $100,000 bug bounty reward from Apple after they patched a flaw that could have allowed an attacker to compromise basically any account that's linked with an Apple ID on one of these participating services. So to run through this flaw, it was actually like all things considered really simple. We've seen a lot of bug bounties where it's like a pretty insane like exploit chain they have to go through to get code execution on something or whatever. And this one is pretty simple from an exploit standpoint. So to sign in with Apple, it uses something called a JSON web token, which is basically JSON data, so formulated web data that then Apple signs with a private key. And then services can validate this JSON web token using Apple's public key, kind of similar to HTTPS encryption, where you can verify Apple's certificate using the public key of their CA, blah, 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 blah. So Bhavok found that Apple had an endpoint, or as a part of this process of obtaining this JSON web token during this authentication with Apple, he could request a web token for basically any email address that he wanted, which would then be signed by Apple's private key, and then he could use these forged requests which would be successfully validated on the third-party services. And then once they're validated, they'd be associated with this whatever email he put in there. So if those services just validated off the email field, he could gain access to them, basically. And as part of their investigation, though, Apple checked their logs. They said they didn't identify any misuse or compromises from this vulnerability, but they still awarded him a $100,000 bug bounty because it is a very serious flaw.
Yeah,
and pretty simple. Like, the fact that they just weren't validating what email address was included in the request is pretty nuts from a company as big as Apple. Like, everyone makes mistakes, but that's kind of crazy.
Yeah, and I would even say pretty good, but hopefully the audience knows by now we're being sarcastic when we talk about Apple being bulletproof. But that sarcasm aside, even though they're not bulletproof, I will say that I tend to respect their security team. They tend to make pretty good security decisions in general, if you think about their secure enclave on their phone and how they encrypt data. So this is a pretty phenomenal mess up, considering how good their security team typically is.
They obviously do care a lot about security. Like, $100,000 is nothing to sneeze at when it comes to a bug bounty. So I'm really impressed with that.
I'll say the good news for this is, despite Apple's huge popularity apparently in mobile phones, luckily them as kind of a federated access as this internet-based identity, they must not be that popular yet, because you mentioned that Dropbox, Spotify, Airbnb, and Giphy use them, which are, you know, all of those are decent sites. But to be honest, that's a small amount. Like, if you go to these sites that allow you to log in, it's most often Google and Facebook. And Apple, I think this whole, what do they call it again, sign-in with Apple, is less leveraged so far. So luckily, just because they're less leveraged so far, maybe that minimizes the impact.
Yep.
And the also, other key thing, if I understand right, is this only allows you to use Apple accounts to get into those sites, but not to actually get into your Apple account.
Correct. Yes. And also only if that site isn't following Apple's published best practices as well. So they actually, Apple, in their documentation for their API for the service, they say that participating services shouldn't rely just on the email as an authenticator, mostly because people can change their email addresses. And so if that's your identifier for a user, if they change their email, then it's basically a new account when it comes to your service. They do include a unique ID instead that is the same even if a user changes their Apple ID email. And if you're validating off of that, that one cannot be spoofed. But if you're a service that isn't properly validating as you should and following the best practices, such as Apple not following the best practices with setting up their JSON Web Token infrastructure, you could have had your accounts compromised from this if they were just validating the email. So it's obviously the scope or the impact is a little smaller just based off of not a whole lot of places using it. And also you would have had to be going against Apple's best practices. But still a pretty huge flaw, and it's good that Apple patched it and paid out quite heavily for it to this researcher.
As an aside, by the way, we've worked with a guy called Roger Grimes, a well-known security guy, wrote a lot of books, who talks about how even multi-factor can be hacked, depending on its setup and stuff. And some of us at WatchGuard are actually editing one of his upcoming books. But this is just a classic example. This isn't multi-factor necessarily, but it's when you're looking at the different factors associated with authentication, and especially when, you know, you have something like OAuth, which is a cool standard, but this idea of this internet-based identity, you know, these little chinks in the big chain of security are what allow things like multi-factor systems or whatever to be hacked. You know, even if you had multi-factor maybe on your OAuth authentication, you know, this suddenly could get anyone else to use your OAuth identity.
You're actually exactly correct with that. Like, Apple ID does support multi-factor authentication, but because of where he was able to modify the email address in here, like, it wouldn't matter. The token would be generated for that account, just like if they had used multi-factor. So this is a way to break MFA that falls under the insecure implementations category.
Very similar to session cookies, which are sometimes talked about depending on how you implement it. You can have a multi-factor authentication to a website, but then if that shares some sort of session cookie with you, if someone's able to fish that session cookie, it gets right past the multi-factor because you've already authenticated. You have the session cookie. So these are the kind of mechanisms and authentication you kind of have to think about as you're threat modeling and trying to figure out how to secure and make the whole digital authentication process stronger.
And if you're a user, just assume that nothing is great and just delete all your accounts because there's no way to stay safe from these types of attacks.
Or partner with cool security companies that offer multi-factor, and while nothing's ever perfect, security companies tend to try to focus on all these little details to minimize these sorts of threats and weaknesses.
There we go. Way to pay the bills, Corey. Hey everyone, thanks again for listening. As always, if you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. If you have any questions on today's topics or suggestions for future episode topics, you can reach out to us on Twitter. I am at @XORRO_. Corey is at @SecAdept. And the both of us are at #the443podcast. Thanks again for listening, and you'll hear from us next week.
Yep, and as you're hashtagging our podcast, make sure to go out and stand up for what you believe in. I won't pretend to know what that is, but you should stand up for it.
Well said.